Blog Talk Radio.
Forwarded to an automatic voice message system. 6 1 9 7 2 3 6 6 7 is not available. At the tone, please record your message.
I see one on the cover or something. I don't know what happened. That's the number that my publicist gave me. Chris, this is Leo from the LA Stool Show. You were scheduled to be on tonight at 7 o'clock Eastern Standard. Give us a call. You can call this number at call-in number at 646-915-9505. And anybody listening live right now can also call that number at 646-915-9505. And let's see. We're still on here. Guess not. Okay. So... get out on that, and we'll try to call him again later. I don't know what happened. That was the number I was given by his publicist. So let's see. That's too bad. It's too bad. Something must have happened. We have this guy has not that I would. Not that things are, well, I don't know exactly how to say this, but the book itself is such a remarkable thing, and it's, we'll just read the back cover of it here, and hopefully he'll call in. It'd be nice if he did. But let me give you a little background of him, and if we're not, for some reason tonight we can't speak to him, we will try him again, you know, another time. But as for right now, it's not going to work. But what I'd like to mention about him, and again, for those of yeah. So anyway, I just wanted to let you know what's going on here. Hopefully we'll be able to talk to him again, I'm hoping. But let me try him again. See if maybe he stepped out to... Hang on 1 second.
Hello?
Oh,
hi.
Is Christopher there?
Unfortunately,
Hello? He
is out. And hi. You need if you could call him back at 661.
This is not on the air,
correct?
This is to be on the air, right? This is live.
Okay. Okay. Well, I can't do that then. He has just tried to call
you
from a different number.
You Michelle?
Yes, I am.
Oh, you're Amber.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, okay.
Michelle.
Michelle.
Yes.
Wait a minute. Are you Michelle?
Yes, I'm Christopher's wife.
Oh, okay. Well, maybe you can talk to us about it. Since you're the co-author.
Well, he's trying to call you on the emergency backup line right now from a different phone number.
Oh, I see. Okay. Also, why don't you, if you can, have him call me on the guest call-in number, if you can talk to him.
Okay.
It's 646-915-9505.
All right. I will certainly do that.
Yeah,
I'm sorry that we're having this technical difficulty here.
On live, okay?
All right. Thank you, Neil.
Right.
Bye-bye.
Okay, bye-bye. And that was his wife, who's also the co-author, but I believe he's wanted to do the he's the one that does the interviews. So hopefully he'll be calling in soon and on this number. And let me just tell you what happened to him. I mean, this is a unique discussion with Christopher. A long and surprising journey brought on by his family's inheritance given to him by Robert Kennedy's personal secretary upon her death, which is a very strange connection to how he was related this way. But what she gave him included documents regarding JFK's assassination and a gold watch JFK was wearing when he was shot. And Christopher spent several years in federal prison because of this, of having this, okay, and being interrogated and brutalized, basically, for knowing too much and wondering where, you know, the CIA and FBI and everybody, and he was sent to a federal prison, and just for having this stuff, okay, and saying where he got it, and, you know, he was trying to... find out what to do with it. And when they found out he had it, my God, that was the beginning of the end for him. And he's now, in the last few years, he's now been able to, he wrote this book last year, or published it last year, I believe in November, it came out. And, he's been on several interviews and done a number of things, but his story is very strange and very different, and the book is very different, and it has a remarkable I don't know how to say. If you're into JFK theories, this is a good one, all right. And I think I don't know. I was hoping we'd be able to talk to him tonight, and it doesn't appear that he's going to be available. But personal testimony in a trying day values highly. This is from, I believe this was written by the publisher, Chris Milligan. And I'll check it out. I wasn't quite expecting this problem tonight, but I was going to read the introduction from Dick Russell, but I should probably read the introduction by the publisher, Chris Mulligan from Trinday. And takes a lot of credit. Oh, hold on a second. Got a strange. This might be him. Hold on 1 second. Hello?
Hello?
Hello? You're on the line.
Yes,
is this Christopher? Yeah.
Hey, sir. How are you?
I would never have known you were at this particular number, okay, that you called in on. Okay. Your publicist gave me that number to call, the other one. And so sorry, I missed you.
No, that's all right. I had another number to call you and then this one, so at least we've hooked up.
Okay. Excuse me. I had a moment of talk there with your wife, who I guess is also the co-author of this book, Michelle. Is
that's
that correct?
Correct.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. So that was quite an endeavor. I was just mystified by the whole thing, to tell you the truth. I've never believed the official, you know, Warren report, and I don't think 80% of the country does. And the other 20 doesn't really care anymore, but I think that it's overwhelming to know that this journey that you are on was such a strange one. But one I would like to ask you before we begin is I think just to preface this is your family's involvement with Robert Kennedy's second secretary. How did that become your in the book you mentioned that you knew them, your family had known her. Is that correct?
Well, my family, my father had worked for a very small task force of President Kennedy, and my mother had known Robert Kennedy briefly, but Evelyn Lincoln, who was President Kennedy's personal secretary for 12 years, basically
right.
Gave all of these materials that Robert Kennedy had taken from the White House and all the stuff that was evidence in the assassination for his purpose was transferred to one of my close friends in Catonsville, Maryland, and just blocks from my lawyer, so he called me up to help him decipher there's vast amounts of material and to go through them together and to, you know, write a book and get a museum open. And that's where I came on board with this. And then, of course, I also got heavily invested in it and was put through the same kind of process that he was. So that's how I came.
What happened to you is unbelievable. Maybe you can explain to – for your having this information that basically was inherited – you wound up in some hell of a time, you know, in federal prison and some real trouble, and you basically seem to have fell into it innocently, then just pursued it and that's when you got in all kinds of trouble. What actually? Maybe you can explain to listeners what actually happened to you at that time when you were starting to get your book together, when you were living, I guess, in Vancouver. Is that correct?
Yeah, I was in Vancouver at the time. Yeah.
Right. And then you started to collect all of this information that you could, and you were working also with your friend there, White, I believe it was. I forget the name. I'm sorry.
Robert White,
was working with you on the book and got in the trouble with you.
Are we on now?
Yeah, this is live.
Okay.
Yeah, you're on now.
Well, I'd like to just explain briefly the fact that the materials were coming out at a time, and I was trying to get the evidence, the crucial evidence that was in my possession, back to the Kennedy
right.
family. And at the time in 96, they reviewed that. Caroline Kennedy had reviewed this, but did not want to deal with it. And so
right.
As we progressed on this, Mr. Trump, Donald Trump, who was not president at the time, this was late 97, had come forward and said, listen, I want to help you guys get this out to the American public. And so we began that process. And as he helped get us a platform, we used New York and CNN and all these other contacts that he had to start getting this stuff out there. But at the same time, I was dealing with JFK Jr. trying to transfer this evidence in secret. So I could not take any interviews at that time. I couldn't talk about this. And he wanted to be the one to break this with the American public. Now, the real problem was that during this period was the AARB investigation, the Assassination Records Review Board investigation on the Kennedy assassination through the Clinton White House. And the evidence that Robert White and I had basically threw a monkey wrench in the whole thing. And so they did not want this information to be going through the AARB or to be made public. So the
crash of JFK, that was a bit untimely and right during that period, wasn't it?
When JFK Jr. crashed, $1 million had been talked about and transferred to Switzerland, and then he gained the closest physical evidence to the frontal head wound that President Kennedy had taken in Dallas. And so he was going to utilize that through George Magazine, and he's already gone down and interviewed Castro and talked with several other people about all this. So, yeah, it was extremely concerning, and I think if he would have been able to do that in 1999 and really address this, I think that we would have had a drastic change in U.S. policy and how our system was working politically. But, of course, they did not happen.
The rumor at that time during his crash was, after his crash, was basically, it was another Clinton. They were afraid of him running for president again.
Well, I've been asked to discuss this specifically, but I can tell you that JFK Jr. was very interested and was pursuing the information in his father's death and his uncle's death, and was going to make that public to the American people at the appropriate time through George Magazine, which would not have been censored. So obviously he was that would have been a threat to the establishment. They certainly didn't want our information coming forward at the time, and then of course everybody involved. I went to federal prison for many years. My mother was brought in on this. She died of a stroke. Robert White died of a heart attack. My lawyer that had very critical information that was documented in his safe died of a heart attack. And on and on and on it goes. JFK Jr. died of plane crash. So all the people that were involved
you came out of this well, but you must have come out of it very, very scarred. You have a family, young family, and, you know, things are looking up for you. What was your motivation? How did you get out of that?
I prayed God every day, and the fact that I prayed that I could have a family and get through this. But the prison really saved my life in a lot of ways. It protected me being inside there, and it was a hellish situation, and of course it changed you permanently. And it took me many years to recover, and I still have trauma and scars from it. But it's amazing to me that the truth of this has been covered, and the purposes of why it's been covered. And I began to understand all of that, what Bobby Kennedy was facing and dealing with after his brother's assassination, what Russia's involvement was, and what Cuba, the catalyst to Cuba. So I was understanding all of this. And within 9 days of the assassination of John F. Kennedy, he was making major government reforms, major changes that would have changed the policy of the United States and the world. So it's a very serious matter, and it's a very sober matter, and the history is true. And unfortunately, what I had to learn was that I was not going to be patted on the back for this, that my government was not going to welcome this insight. So in fact, they were going to condemn me and put me through the same process that they would use for a terrorist of the United States. And I was lucky to survive all of that attack, and it was a very, very unpleasant and watch people die, and it was very, very scarring. But the important thing for the American people to understand is that they have been lied to, that the truth was never revealed correctly. I think most people know that or believe that. Mm-hmm. And they should understand why these men died, why they gave their lives. They protected they protected the rest of us from the plans that had been evolved since World War II, that were going to take us to a first strike in Moscow and kill many tens of millions of American citizens. And the Kennedy brothers were not going to allow that to happen. So it's a very, very important part of our history, and a lot of it answers why we are and where we are right now. And I think if people want to find out about that and learn about what actually took place and what Bobby Kennedy was doing to protect our interests, and what he had to deal with. I would like them to be able to at least learn about that and read the book.
I have to tell you, there was a fascinating book, and I quoted it in my own book because I interviewed the authors of that book, and it's called The Assassinations. And it was written by a fellow named Chris DiEugenio and Lisa Pease. They're out in California, and they did they had a magazine that they were publishing called it was a Probe magazine, and it talked about this the investigation of five different liberal leaders from the 1960s, and how those assassinations, one of them being JFK and the other Bobby Kennedy. The first, though, oddly enough, is Malcolm X. And there's Malcolm X, John F. Kennedy, Robert Kennedy, Martin Luther King, and there was a fifth, and I forget, there was a fifth one. The fifth one was John Lennon, all right, in 1980. So later, because of the effect that he had and what he understood. But those five, that was the liberal movement of the 60s and the 70s. And that was, and for to lose all of those guys within the 10-year period, all right, just destroyed the movement, you know, the liberal movement, the anti-war movement, the everything, you know, that was that went ahead, and that they showed that it was a conservative sea change that was that you know, and the government actually killed the FBI. They found killed Martin Luther King Jr. And they killed the Kennedys. All right, and the only one they couldn't pin the government on was Malcolm X, you know. So, but that was questionable as well. But those were incredibly important things that happened and documented, and it changed my attitude as well when I read that book. Just like yours is a mind changer, you know, and a thought changer. And I used to have Jim Mars on my program quite often. He passed away a couple of years back. You might have known some of his work, Crossfire and so on, that he did on the JFK assassination. But what I was trying to get at is that what happened with JFK with his death was frightening. And when early on with the was it the Zuter, the guy that's the name who took the famous film of JFK getting shot, was it Zuter's film or Zuter?
Zapruder film.
Zapruder, okay, yeah. His film that showed that. But I was amazed, and I was absolutely amazed that when I found out that every single witness to that event wound up dying an unusual death within a year or so of the assassination,
the truth,
right?
Every
witness that came forward,
yeah,
wound up, saying, there were two people. He was shot from the front. He wasn't shot from the back. Or here's, you know, they had evidence. Or they had movie cameras and stuff like that. But they all died mysterious deaths, well within a year or so after the incident. And you got a lot of guts.
Yeah, when the U.S. government was extraditing me on this purpose, they didn't want to share the real reasons with the Canadian government why they were bringing me down. But my lawyer had prepared a document and legally documented all these individuals that had perished and involved in this to try to fight the extradition process. Although I capitulated on that and we didn't wind up fighting it. But the fact remains is that what's what's interesting is not only, you know, where we find ourselves today, but if you look back at what was happening with us behind the scenes in 97, 96, 98, the book actually, I tried to take the reader through the behind the scenes with the FBI, with the Justice Department, with the CIA, with the Clintons, with the Kennedy family, and so forth and so on, with Russian intelligence, with all these individuals that behind the scenes, what it's like to go through this process, what it means, who's in charge of this, who's making the decisions, who's pulling the strings, who makes these choices as to whether the American public officially will change the story. Or the Justice Department has been given orders through the Clinton White House and through the CIA. The CIA has directed them to say, listen, you are not to prosecute anybody. There's no prosecutions in this case, so there's no interest in pursuing this case for the Justice Department. The only door that is open is if a Kennedy family member, someone like JFK Jr., would go ahead and open up the cold case down in Texas. That's the only way they're going to reopen this and reevaluate this. And they didn't want that to happen either. And of course, the Kennedy family has been through so much trauma over all this, and the powers that be, that I'm sure that they are in a position that they don't want to open these doors. JFK Jr.
Oh, I'm sure they don't. I'm sure they don't. And
his mother had passed.
Dan was ambassador to Japan or something, and she's got a life. But my God. That family, I mean, you just, you know, just amazing what happened to them. And of course, John Jr. for wanting to open it back up. And I was convinced he was, he was assassinated, just like his father, because I wasn't sure at the time why, but the rumor was that he was planning to run for president, right? And got in some people's way, and they didn't want certain things to come out. But I was amazed, that he actually spoke to Ronald Reagan. You actually spoke to Reagan.
JFK Jr. would have pursued the intentions of his father and his uncle before him. And, of course, that made him very dangerous. And if he was going to breach this with the American public, which I know that he was, that would made him extremely dangerous, because everybody that – all the infrastructure that has gone to this point where we are now would be a suspect and opened up and questionable. And nobody wants to open those doors, that Pandora's box. Nobody wants to go there. And so someone like myself or someone like Robert White –
I noticed that you had Trump. I was surprised that you had Trump in your book as encouraging this thing to come out and helping you. This was what year was it that he started?
This was 97.
Early 2000s or
2007? 97. And
97.
I don't have directives.
It was 97 when he helped you. Okay, because
I was
convinced, because he was always he always was a conspiracy theorist. You know, he used to headline the. He became good friends with Alex Jones. And Alex, I had Alex Jones on my show a number of times back in the heydays. But he started out with the Birther movement. He actually started out with 9-1-1. You know, he started talking about it. You know, he thought that it didn't make any sense. But he cornered the market on conspiracy theorists, so people started listening to him, and it was kind of encouraging, but it turned out that he was probably the biggest conspirator that I've ever read about in my life, you know. I don't know your opinion on Trump, but it's, you know, mine is quite out there. But how did he appear get involved with you, especially? I think people might want to be interested in that story.
You're talking about
Trump,
Mr. Trump.
With your story.
Mr. Trump has took an interest in these materials and was aware of them. He may have been briefed by someone. I'm sure that he was. I mean, and he wanted – his interest was similar to ours, which was how we were going to resolve this as a nation. Are we going to bring this out to the American public and discuss it as an open forum? And then resolve some of these issues to move forward in a better direction. I I believe that was his intention, although he made no direct comment to the press about that. But he certainly gave us a platform to work with, and of course that platform backfired on us, because as soon as CNN and everybody got on board, that's when the Justice Department gave a full control through the White House to attack, and they certainly did.
Know,
they attacked all of us. Yeah.
You know, this
yeah,
is this is something that I maybe you can clarify this a little better about for me, but. Since you're familiar with him so much. His whole thing of draining the swamp, but going at the deep state, you know, and he understood that part, and I think a lot of people do, okay, especially after what happened with JFK and RFK Martin Luther King. Those three assassinations there, they were all state-sponsored, you know, and they were virtually proven to be. But even in the, I think it was in 1999, the Martin Luther King, the King family, settled with the government for an undisclosed amount of money for wrongful death. The government was responsible for the wrongful death of Martin Luther King Jr. So once that was revealed in a book, so I read the book and talked to the author about that. That was about 10 years ago it came out. But the evidence was there. The trial was there, and the verdict was clear. You know, the FBI and the government, assassinated Martin Luther King. And that was because Martin Luther King was going after Johnson's Vietnam War, you know, and it was a war on poverty, you know, rather than the race war so much. And Johnson got really pissed off at him because, Johnson thought he was the savior with his war on poverty and, civil rights. But then after Martin Luther King got his Peace Prize, he turned on the war on poverty, you know, and concentrated on that, and it kind of foiled, it kind of screwed up Johnson's plans. But since Johnson, it appears, was also might have been involved with JFK's assassination. Is that correct?
Johnson is certainly aware of what was going to happen, and very aware of all that day as well. But
there was a story about what happened then, and I forget exactly where I read it. But it was an eyewitness who was actually in a Secret Service agent was actually in the car with Johnson. As he came around the Texas book reservoir, where Oswald supposedly shot. As they were turning the corner, okay, in the motorcade, he ducked down in his seat. Right? Shot hadn't been fired yet, but he ducked down in his seat, and within about 15 or 20 seconds after he did that, the shot was fired, the shots were fired that killed Kennedy. So it was
JFK Jr., we discussed the fact that the Secret Service could not be trusted. The agencies involved in the federal government cannot be longer be trusted to serve properly and correctly. So he had discussed with me one of the reasons he wanted to be part of what I was be able to offer him was to show the American public that he needed a private security force. In other words, to protect himself, he was going to run for office.
Right.
And, of course, it's interesting. He was talking with Mr. Trump about this. I don't have direct one-on-one correlation of how much they discussed this, but President Trump does not rely solely on the Secret Service. He has a private security team runs himself and protects himself. He also carries a gun with him. So he understood this just as well as JFK Jr. did. And I find it very interesting that he's put in those applications for himself rather than JFK Jr. taking it on because he was killed. So it's it really goes to show you where our
said Trump carries a gun and has his own security team.
That's correct.
Is that what you said? Yeah.
That's correct.
No,
I
know, Secret Service. But he has his own security team as well. But I forgot his name, but the guy who was his security guy for 20 years, resigned last year, I believe, or the year before, last year, I think. Are you remember that? Were you familiar with that? With Trump's, advisor?
No.
Trump's security guy, top security guy that he had for 20 years, resigned from that. And then he wound up suing Trump for the 20 years of overtime when he got out of there. Imagine that.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, 20 years of overtime that he never got paid. But anyway,
I think I think a lot of people are very confused. But if you understand from what I went through behind the scenes, you understand that.
Oh,
Clintons,
God, man, what you went through.
Are not interested.
It's probably tough to do that, but I think it's critical that people understand what kind of torture, basically, and hell you went through that time in prison. And being there for such a convoluted, thing, well, you were in federal pen, and then they were trying. What were they trying to do to you? Brainwash you, or trying to kick it out of you, or what?
Well, their immediate idea is to break your resolve and to get you disoriented. When I first got into the U.S. custody of the marshals, they put me aboard federal aircraft. Every day for a month, I was up on the tarmac first thing in the morning in chains. We'd go to 10,000 feet. We'd fly for 10 minutes and come back down. We'd go up and down all day long, and we did that every day. And that's all over the country to disorient you. And then they put me into – I got into another facility where I slept in a military coffin for about a month. I had to sleep because so overcrowded there. And then I went to another prison, Baltimore City, in a jail, and I slept on cobblestone and urine and feces for a while, which is a very old prison.
God.
When I finally got back out to the Fourth Circuit federal court where the indictments came from, the sealed indictments, that place was a maximum security holding facility with German shepherds and all these other things, which you're kept in a confined, and they come in and beat you with clubs. I watched one man die while I was there. Another man went out with lethal injection, on and on and on it goes. So it's a very, very severe.
What were those poor guys in there for? I mean, you were in there for – your thing. What were some of those guys in there for?
Well, we had one gentleman in there that was a Catholic priest that was in there for demonstrating against nuke weapons, and had been on a military base, and they gave him 6 months, which is the minimum the feds will give. But they put him in there, and two nuns. They gave them each 6 months for trying to protest against these deployment of nukes. But it's a wide range of things from political to people that have committed mass murder.
One of the Kerrigan brothers, or was that that was in there? A Catholic priest that went to a nuclear that broke. Were Kerrigan brothers, I think that both of them. They were Catholic priests that had gone anti-nuke, and were breaking into the military facilities, and actually sitting on top of aircraft carriers and stuff like that, what did they do to him? Did they just beat him or what?
Well, I wanted to answer the question before. Is the immediate idea is to break you down and cut you off, and so that you start to break. And as you're going through this, I had one of my cellmates, his wife committed suicide. They wouldn't let her come in to see him. I had another guy that was a cellmate. Get life in prison. So it's to break you down. After about a year of that, after they attacked my family and threatened them, I capitulated, and then I had to go in. I signed an agreement for protection, which the government said will give you a protection from this national security materials that you've been involved with, but you have to answer all our questions in a debrief session, and you have no right to counsel. You have no rights at all. And if we find that you have not told the truth in any way, that once the FBI and the CIA investigates this, we'll give you 50 years in prison. So I had to agree to that and go in and get debriefed several times in closed session that was sealed, and go through that process. And that was a very scary thing, to be facing 50 years in prison. I believe the gentleman that broke the waterboarding to the Bush administration for the CIA was also facing 40 years for his time for what he had said. But it's a very heavy-handed situation. It's very, very real and very scary.
Oh, man. It's a miracle that you, I guess those prayers really, really got you through that. But I don't know. You know, the more I learn about my government, you know, the more frightened I am. And I've been doing this program for, and television, radio, for 20 years, and on internet as well. But and I had extremely difficult ride trying to break that hold on them, on the conservative hold on the media, that government hold on the media, that Jewish hold on the media, the cabal basically of censorship in this country, but it took a lot of brave guys, a lot of brave radio owners, station owners, and of course, Blog Talk and the networks that started off on this stuff. And I've got almost 1,400 programs archived on this station, on this network. But it's amazing that the depth of discussions like I'm having with you, and the people that have been censored and finally got on. And my shows weren't censored, but some of them were, you know what I mean? And it was, oh my God. Whenever I went a little too far on the exposing things, sometimes the sections would be edited out. They would be blocked out.
That's absolutely right. Consensus needs to understand that we don't have a free press in the United States anymore. You are not getting open and non-biased communication.
No. I agree with you. I spent a good portion of this morning actually watching the Barr testimony, after I saw after I watched that, what I'm talking about, right? The Attorney General in front of the Senate. That was some kind of I can't remember an attorney general like lying as much as this guy has, maybe next to John Mitchell back in 74, 73, who was Richard Nixon's attorney general.
They threatened to jail him. Tail caught in the door too. I want to just say this, or my wife will get upset. We're going to be selling books on May 22nd down at the Last Bookstore in Los Angeles. So if anybody's interested
I can say that here. Yeah, the Last Bookstore in Los Angeles. I wanted to promote
Last
your website too, the CSM.
That's cmfulton.com. It's cmfulton.com, and they can go there and they can see documents from my Justice Department file, and they can. They can see kind of the structure of that was.
There's a couple of great videos you have on there too, and interviews you did, and I got a kick out of the one that you did with Chris, your publisher, Chris Milligan, John Barber, I think.
John Barber. John Barber's
website.
Great. Yeah, he's a great individual, and then, of course, it's got a lot of Garrison's original material. And keeping, and really that needs to come forward, because Garrison was working for the benefit of the people of the United States, and he was made a fool of, and that was wrong. But I really believe that this is.
I got to hand it to you. I just got to hand it to you. But for you to get out there and be able to publish this stuff, how were you able to do that? Chris has a lot of connections, but how were you able to?
I was approached. Somebody came out from Washington. I can't say who they were, but they know all the first families, and they meet with the CIA every week. They said, "We know you're going to write a book." I said, "Yes, I'm going to write a book." They said, "Well, we want to do two things, three things actually. One, we want you to meet with Mike Pence in Virginia, and debrief him. I said, why do they want me to meet with Mike Pence? They said, because they were trying to clean up the agency and want you to debrief him on this situation. The next thing they asked was, they said, write it as based on a true story, not a true story. I said, that way you can get the book out. And the other thing they say is don't chase anybody down. Don't put anybody in a corner that's going to embarrass them and put them in a bad position. If you do those things, you can try to get this book squeaked in. Otherwise, it won't get out at all.
Wow. Wow. No, I think that, that's pretty much is the way it is. Now, who contacted you? Was that the CIA or government or Mike?
Well,
I have been contacted by
someone of CIA, and I did not take the meeting. I turned the meeting down.
That's interesting, because what they're doing now, and I don't particularly agree with it, but I think from your perspective, it must be unique that.
It wasn't Mike Pence. It was Pompeo. I'm sorry. It was Pompeo they asked me to meet, not Mike Pence. Pompeo. So my error.
That's even worse. Okay. He was the head of CIA then. Yeah. Right?
Yeah, he was the head of the CIA. Correct. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. And that's interesting. You didn't meet him. And he didn't. Did he send you a follow-up request by somebody knocking on your door or no?
Well, I mean, I can certainly appreciate the fact that these what they're trying to do or what they're interested in doing. But a lot of these people, the CIA, they've been around a long time, and they've got agreements in place that none of them are going to be prosecutable. The Clintons are not prosecutable. People don't understand this. They don't understand that Mr. Trump cannot indict Hillary Clinton, put her in prison, and even if he could. It would start to bring down the infrastructure of the United States government. So people have to people need to be made aware of how the structure exists and the secrecy exists, so that it perpetuates and we keep getting blindsided and the American people keep losing. And I want the American people, we're a great country, we're great people, and I want us to start winning and getting the truth out there to the world.
Oh yeah, no, I've agreed to that for many, many, many years. In fact, I've lost teaching positions because of it, because of my radio show, my activism, and my writing and book, but that is part of the what we're doing, I guess. I don't know what was it for you to do this. I know what's behind my motivation, but yeah, what is your motivation? To continue to.
My motivation is to honor the people that died in this process. I mean, my mother passed away, was attacked terribly, and had a massive stroke, and my friend died, and my lawyer died, and JFK Jr. died, and then, of course, the President of the United States and Robert Kennedy also passed away in their efforts to make a better and more peaceful world. I mean, I think I owe it to all of these individuals because my information that's in the National Archives, which my name appears there, the file has been removed. And there's no pull slip. We did a 30-day investigation there, and they can't figure out who pulled it. Was it one of the agencies? Was it the President of the United States? We don't know who pulled it. So the American people are never going to get this piece of information. This part of the story would have not been known if I hadn't come forward. And believe me, this was not an easy decision for me to make.
I sat on this information for
a long time. It was very difficult. But in the end, I didn't want to die with it. At my deathbed, I kept that to myself, and I shouldn't have done that. And that would be a huge mistake, and I think it would be very unfair. And so I think that I owe it to the people that have died bravely and fought for all of us, for our families, for your family, for my family. I owe it to all of them to speak up and say what happened.
Unbelievable. No, I am so proud of you, actually, to be talking to you, actually, because yeah, to me, you're an icon. You're a patriot.
Believe me, I am a survivor, somebody who loves the country, but I'm a survivor. But there's a lot of great people that have paid the ultimate price and they've with their lives. And those are the real heroes that we should look to. And we should understand why they died. If you ask most Americans why President Kennedy was killed, most Americans don't even have a clue why the man was killed. If you ask people why did Bobby Kennedy get killed, they don't have a clue. They don't have any idea what these men were making these decisions consciously to saying, I'll put my life on the line. I'll give up everything I've got for the betterment of the world and for the people of the United States. It's worth it. It's worth every effort because if I don't do it, who's going to do it? And that's, and we need to honor that. We need to understand.
You know, the courage of those guys. There's no doubt. You know, no question. To go up against that huge, huge machine. And
Yeah.
And a few people know that JFK, 2 weeks after he issued $4 billion in U.S. Silverbacks, he suddenly got shot. All right, but he was trying to get rid of the Federal Reserve, you know. And
President Kennedy could have lived
been
a very good, comfortable life without the public service and without trying to do what he did. Jackie Kennedy was scared out of her mind. I mean, I've read her wills.
That poor woman. It was what she went through. Can you imagine just the horror and the PTSD you would have after you sit there and watch your husband get shot in the head?
Who are you going to talk to about this?
It's a horrible thought.
Who are their contemporaries? Who are they going to share that with? Who can they talk to about that? I mean, it's certainly a unique experience.
And you know,
the thing
that amazes me too about a woman like Jackie Kennedy. I mean, she was iconic. She was the icon for decades after that.
Yeah.
Before and after that, in fashion and style and memory and whatnot. And to this day, she's still. I mean, people my age can all remember her tour of the White House after they decorated the White House, you know, things like that.
Yeah.
They were just a remarkable family.
The Kennedys led by example. You know, there's a lot of things that have been, attacking them over the years, and there's a lot of things that have been said diminish what President Kennedy was all about and everything else, which is a load of hogwash.
I think the Kennedy concept, the classic Kennedy, is having his memory and his contributions to the country are having a notable rise again, I believe, you know. Especially
as a nation, as a world, our consciousness are changing. We are waking up. We are waking up to the ideas that if I had talked about this 25 years ago, 20 years ago, it would have been impossible for me. But the fact of the matter is, people understand now. They've opened up enough to understand that yes, this is possible. Yes, this is probably highly likely, and it takes that kind of anti-brainwashing to take place so that you can have your mind opened up enough to understand the truth of what's been happening.
Resurgence and publishers like Chris, I wish him a long life, and he's managed to put out some incredible things, books, and many more years of doing that. But in your case, man, I wish you and your wife and your family all the best and all the safety in the world. And
I guess you
have that under control now. And, hope it's nothing but sunshine and roses for you there.
I appreciate that very much, very much. I mean, all of us have a limited time on this planet, and we should make the best of it for each of us. Find happiness, make that a priority, and find courage and find decency to each other. All of these things should be goals that we should encourage in each other and move forward, not this infighting and not this bickering, because that is for purpose, and that's exactly what's been going on. And divided we will fall, and we need the united we stand. I put that on every chapter heading for purpose in my book. United we will stand together, and we will be able to do what was the purpose of this country from the founding, which was a democracy, and not have these elitist or royal people rule over masses of billions amounts of people and treat them like a cattle. What we need is to treat each other well and to have a say in what goes on in our lives, and we need to stand up and take more of a controlling position in this. And I think people are waking up to the ideas. And I encourage that at any time that I get a chance to do so. And like I said, we're the greatest country on Earth, and I have every absolute belief that if people are informed properly, if people are given the truth, that they can make good decisions, conscious decisions for their families and for the future generations of the world.
Yeah, I'll tell you something. You know, that, talking like that, I think I'd consider nominating you for president as a presidential candidate there. You seem to have the right idea. What do you think of the upcoming election? What do you think of the upcoming Democratic candidates, as well as what do you think of Trump?
Well, I think that we have to be more bipartisan. We have to start putting these old ideas of these party systems away and start to understand what's the truth. What's the best system? What's the best answer? How is this going to affect the rest of us in a positive way? How do we get this done quicker without committees or without people being influenced by the large PAC money that's coming in from these corporations that are necessary? It's not a given. Like, well, I'll take some. If these individual senators do not raise, I think it's $45,000 a day, they can't get reelected. They've got to have that money coming in from somewhere. It's an infrastructure that we need to change. We need to get rid of that system get rid of the corruption.
Joe Biden to announce the first day he announces he's going to run, he does a campaign stop and makes $6 million, from Comcast and a couple of health insurance companies. So it's like, obviously Comcast doesn't want them
that
neutrality.
This gets into a whole different thing.
Nobody wants Medicare for all, you know. So
George Washington proved himself.
These guys, you know,
it's
an oligarchy and it's a two-party system, and you can't seem to break it, you know.
That's right.
To break through, and they're making sure that nobody breaks through, you know. And after what you've gone through, and you see what the system really is. And the media really is, for you to be optimistic and not ultimate cynic takes a lot, and I appreciate your attitude and your courage.
All of our problems are man-made. That means that we have the ability to change them, and we have the ability to alter them to the benefit of everyone else, and that needs to be. That needs to be addressed. We can't rely on these infrastructures anymore. The press has proven themselves as an entity for business, and of course our government has done the same. And we're not being represented properly. And if we're not being represented properly, obviously our families and our lives and everything else are at stake. And this is probably one of the most serious issues, if not the most serious issue that we face in our lifetimes and the future of our children. If we don't start taking a severe look at this and looking at ways to change this system, my God, even if it's a first step or second to step, a small step, but let's take the step.
One of the biggest problems I'm seeing lately is this explosion of white supremacy and violence everywhere. I mean, geez, I saw in the news yesterday there was two six-year-old kids had created a hit list for this in their school, and were planning to do were planning to bring guns in and blow away people they didn't like, and they arrested those two sixth graders and put them in a juvie to straighten them out. These kids were already getting ready to blow up a school, for crying out loud.
This is being perpetuated. Around the world, you try to put everybody at each other's throat. You scare them. You're going to lose your position in the world.
Yeah.
People are taking things away from you, et cetera, that you don't have these same beliefs and all these other entities. But the fact of the matter is that all of this is being done for purpose. And when the more they make you feel ineffectual, the more they make everybody feel that they can't make a change, that they're meaningless in life, that every person that's on this planet is here for purpose. They were put here. It was a chance of billions and billions
that's
of
right.
one. They're here for a reason. They have value.
You, yes.
Every person has value, and you've got to reach that what that core of what that value is for you and make a difference. One person can change the world. One person has
right.
changed the world, and so if we feel
well,
as a nation
know, the
as a world,
that, you know what, you know the only problem I got with that is that they always get shot or crucified, you know. And is there any that actually live long and prosperous lives, like some kind of Superman or something, you know?
That's a good question.
Yeah, man,
that
one's always bothered me. And I said, you know, why don't the great ones survive, you know? And I don't know. But, man, I hope you survive. You're a great one. And, you know,
no one person can do that alone. They're going to need help. They're going to need support. And that's where everybody comes into play. I mean, that's where we stand together.
Right.
And we say, no, this is not acceptable to us. This is not how we want to be represented. We don't want to have the threat of Democles and this nuclear stuff and annihilation. So,
right.
Yeah.
Well, time is up, Chris, and I want to thank you again for being on. And feel free to download this and throw it on as another one of your interviews on your site if you want. But it was great. Great talking to you. And
what's nice talking to you, Leo?
Why don't you give the name of your website again for everybody knows where
it's
to go?
cmfulton.com. And then, of course, again, the May 22nd, it will be at the Last Bookstore in Los Angeles to sign books. And, of course, I can answer some questions if people have them there. But
sure, that's fine.
I'm just
Trinday Publications. You can buy the book there as well. And
Amazon. It's on Amazon as well. Yeah, absolutely.
And the book is called The Inheritance, Poison Fruit of the JFK's Assassination. And we wish you the best. All right?
Thank you, sir. Thank you, Leo. Appreciate you having me on.
All right. Good night, guy. Good luck.
Thanks.
And that was Chris Fulton. And that was our show tonight. If you like it, share it with people. Please, again, the book is called The Inheritance, and it's written by Christopher Fulton and his wife, Michelle. And it's a remarkable journey, and it really is of courage amazing guy. So good luck, everybody, and we'll talk to you next week.